All right, I'm going to tell y'all how I like to use one of my favorite tools out in the woods, and that is the tracker from Onyx Hunt. So here's how I've been using it lately. I got this new property I'm going to be hunting this year, and the very first thing I did on the property was I went out and I drove all of the roads that are drivable in my truck, and I had the tracker on as I was driving around. So after I got done driving around, I selected the track on my app and changed it to where it's just a solid black line. So now I've got a really nice, easy to see roadmap of everywhere that's drivable in a truck on the property. So here's what that does for me so far. Now I've got an easy to read map of everywhere that you can drive in a truck on the property. But also that roadmap is actually very useful because it makes it very easy for me to see what roads are drivable and what parts of the property are most accessible and what parts of the property are least accessible. Like I said, one of my favorite tools. If you're not using it already, you should be. And if you want to give Onyx a try, go get an Elite membership and use the promo code Southern at checkout. That's going to save you 20% and it's going to help the show out. Know where you stand with Onyx Hunt. If you hunt deer out of trees, you need to go check out latitudeoutdoors.com. They got a little something for everybody, whether you're a saddle guy or if you hunt out of a climber. Of course, Latitude makes some of our favorite saddles and climbing sticks, but they also make some great packs and backpack straps that you can attach to the bottom of a climbing tree stand to make it more comfortable to carry in the woods. Probably my favorite piece of gear I've gotten in the last several years is the Ranger 22 from Latitude. It's like a do-it-all backpack for me. It's compact, which I like, but it's adjustable enough that it gets me through the whole season. It's the only pack I use. I use it in early bow season, when I'm not carrying much in the woods, all the way to late January rut hunts in the deep south when it's cold and I'm carrying all kinds of clothes and all kinds of stuff on my back. The Ranger 22 is adjustable enough that I can just use that one backpack all season. And hey, all you Mossy Oak Bottomland fans, they just released the Ranger 22 in Mossy Oak Bottomland. So like I said, no matter how you like to hunt, Latitude's got something for you. Go check them out at latitudeoutdoors.com.
Well, guys, meet your new favorite summer scouting optic, and no, it's never too early to start scouting for the fall. Introducing the Vortex Crossfire Spotting Scopes with three different models of how you glass. Me and Andrew have both used spotting scopes in the summer to go out and glass fresh, clear cuts that's got a little bit of growth on them to find bachelor groups actually feeding in the summer. It's a pretty fun time, and also it's a great opportunity to take your kids out, especially if you can sit in the truck while you're glassing. It's always one of those pieces of optics like to keep in the truck at all times because you never know when you might need it. Be sure to stop by your local Vortex dealer to get out the all-new Crossfire Spotting Scopes or to get 10% off your favorite spotter, head over to eurooptic.com and enter code Southern10 at checkout to save 10% on your order.
You know, one reason that we named our company the Southern Outdoorsman is because we're not just Southern deer hunters or Southern turkey hunters. We kind of hunt everything: quail, doves, waterfowl, rabbits, squirrels, you name it. I know a lot of you guys are the same way, and our friends at Whitetail Hill are like that as well. Whether you've got a hunting club, a lease, or your own property, they've got a blend for pretty much every situation on a piece of ground. I mean, they've got a seed blend for everything. If you want warm season deer forage, check out Summer Bulk. If you need to screen off a plot or cover an access route, Hideaway grows up to 12 feet tall and is built for that exact purpose. You got a duck hole or a pond edge? Check out the waterfowl blend. You want to plant for doves or quail? Check out their dove and quail plot. If you need soil that needs a little bit of work before fall, check out Dirt Doctor. And of course, they got a full cool season lineup ready to go when fall planting time gets here. And if you're unsure about what to plant, go to whitetailhill.com. They've got a seed selection guide on there that'll help you pinpoint exactly what you need on your property. So y'all check them out today. That's Whitetail Hill. Go to whitetailhill.com. You know, one reason that we named our company the Southern Outdoorsman is because we're not just Southern deer hunters or Southern turkey hunters. We kind of hunt everything: quail, doves, waterfowl, rabbits, squirrels, you name it. I know a lot of you guys are the same way, and our friends at Whitetail Hill are like that as well. Whether you've got a hunting club, a lease, or your own property, they've got a blend for pretty much every situation on a piece of ground. I mean, they've got a seed blend for everything. If you want warm season deer forage, check out Summer Bulk. If you need to screen off a plot or cover an access route, Hideaway grows up to 12 feet tall and is built for that exact purpose. You got a duck hole or a pond edge? Check out the waterfowl blend. You want to plant for doves or quail? Check out their dove and quail plot. If you need soil that needs a little bit of work before fall, check out Dirt Doctor. And of course, they got a full cool season lineup ready to go when fall planting time gets here. And if you're unsure about what to plant, go to whitetailhill.com. They've got a seed selection guide on there that'll help you pinpoint exactly what you need on your property. So y'all check them out today. That's Whitetail Hill. Go to whitetailhill.com.
go.
Okay, so we're at the NWTF convention with the current Grand National calling champion, Dave Owens. Dave, how are you doing, man?
I'm doing fine. Current for – let's keep saying that because tomorrow it's going to change probably. Tomorrow the new king will be crowned.
I don't know. You could go back-to-back though, right?
It's always possible, but, you know, probably highly unlikely.
I don't know, man. So I used to watch you on YouTube before you did Pinote Project.
Yeah.
All right. So when I first got into turkey hunting, I was watching you like a couple years ago. You had some like older videos you put on there.
Yeah.
And I like wore your videos out because of how you showed the whole hunt. I was learning a lot from it. And then I came up here a couple years ago for the first time, or 2 years ago, for the first time to watch the Grand Nationals. And you got up on stage. I was like, I know who that guy is. You did good. I was like, you should have won. And I can't remember what you placed. But I think you were top five. And then last year you won it. I was good job, man.
Yep, good job. Yep. It was a quick process, or quicker you know, I just started, like, last year was the sixth year I'd called up here. So, when I got up here and watched the guys that won, I was like, man, I want to win that one day, you know. But a lot of times it's a very long, you know, you really got to learn. It's a slow, you know, you pick up bits and pieces every time you're here.
Yeah.
I really didn't expect to be on top that quick, you know. But it was a cool experience for sure.
Now, up until that point, how many years had you been calling – on a competitive level?
That was the first year.
Like, really?
Yeah. Like, because 6 years ago, it was 7 years ago, I guess, when I started and I qualified that first year I started, and I came up here nervous as, you know, I'll get out, and made the cut, you know, the first year. Shouldn't have made the cut, because I go back and listen to it now and I'm like, that was horrible. But somehow I was that guy that had the lucky horseshoe and made the cut. And I made it and got up there and got embarrassed on the finals, you know, probably placed dead last. I can't even remember. And then started from there. So, yeah, that was 6 years ago. So,
yeah. Dude, I love going to that because when you start watching them, you know callers and who you really like. And I like your calling. Mm-hmm. I like Scott Ellis's calling a lot. Just because, I don't know, it just sounds like hens that I hear.
Yeah.
Nasty Alabama swamp hens.
Yeah, yeah. They got that rear end. They're not tinny, and they're not tingy like a lot of those northern turkeys can be. You know, you hear, and I hear it in the turkeys themselves traveling like I do. I hear, you know, some variances in the turkeys, which granted, there's exceptions all over the place. But you can see to where those calling styles are kind of tailored for where somebody's at. You know, they're training their ear, or their ear's trained to mimic the hens that they hear. So, like, but yeah, down here in the south, we got those hens that really got some rear end to them. So
they got that southern accent.
Yeah, they got that draw to them, you know.
I love it, man. So, Dave, tell us a little bit about yourself and what you got going on with Pinote Project.
I'm just a turkey hunter. Don't claim to be much else. It's the only thing I really ever cared to be or care to be currently. So,
yeah.
I started the Pinote Project last year, last season. Like you'd mentioned, I've dabbled with video and turkey hunts. I usually videoed a handful a year when it was convenient for me around home and stuff. But I traveled extensively and have for a number of years. And I would put together, like, you know, people that would ask, I'd show them the pictures from how many ever states it was I'd hunted that year, 8, 10, 12, whatever it was. And like, man, you ought to video the whole thing. I'm like, you know, it is not an easy process to drag this camera around and document this stuff, even when it's convenient, like when you're hunting next to home. But enough people were asking for it and wanting it, and I was watching the way everything else as far as turkey media was going, and it was so far from the way I hunted and the way I learned to hunt, and I thought, man, there needs to be something out there that portrays the way I like to turkey hunt. And there was nothing even remotely close. So yeah, we just kind of jumped in with both feet with the whole you know, there was like a, I guess it came with a warning label. Like, hey, if you're looking for premier turkey footage, turkeys coming across fields, slow motion shots, you know, all of this stuff, then you're tuning into the wrong show, because we are more about the process. We enjoy the process of the whole hunt and what comes together. And hunting a lot of public land turkeys and hardwood turkeys and turkeys in the mountains is what I really just – that's what drives me. Obviously, I'll kill them anywhere, but but it's the mountain turkeys that really I love. Hunt turkeys in the woods. Just didn't see much of that, so we threw our hat in the ring and chased them for a lot of mornings. And
yeah,
I looked into that camera every doggone morning as much as I didn't want to. Toward about, after about day 20, it got old, you know. I was man, I'm done with this. But I did. I stayed true to my word and looked into that camera every morning, tried to carry everybody along. And as terrible as some of the days may be, and you know how they shook out. So
yeah. Yeah, that's something that we talked about all throughout deer season where, like, everyone knows, like, the hunting public, they've been hugely successful. And that's one reason I think they've been so successful is they show the process more so than the result. And especially for someone who's learning how to hunt, it helps when you see that failure and you see days that you're struggling and how you get through that, how you cope with it, or what steps you take to get out of whatever situation you're in. That's really helpful for someone who's trying to learn something from your videos.
And strategy, everybody talks about strategy, and I think the misconception is, oh, if you employ this strategy that somebody's talking about, it's going to work. Mm-hmm. Well, when you watch somebody that's talking about that strategy, put that strategy to work and see that it doesn't work all the time, it puts you into, like, you know, you're surrounded by reality at that point. Like, yes, this is a proven strategy. It is successful, but it's not successful every time. Nothing is. Mm-hmm. So when you see that, you know, by the guys who are actually preaching it, it's easier to swallow. You're like, immediately, if you think you did it and it didn't work for you, I must have done it wrong. No, you can do it right and it not work. That's we're hunting wild animals. You know, they don't volunteer to get shot at. So, you know.
Yeah, and especially like when we're hunting public land, we hunt public land quite a bit. And I'm super green. Like I told you that before we started recording, I'm super green at turkey hunting. I've only been doing it for a couple of years now. Started when I was younger growing up, and it was more like deer hunting. We'd go with my uncles, and we'd sit, had an 80-acre family farm, and we'd sit green fields waiting for birds to come by. Like, you'd call, but you'd wait.
Yeah.
And I hated that. So I got out turkey hunting for a while and then got back in it with him hunting public land birds. And like you said, not one tactic will always work every time. And that's the biggest thing is, you know, you hear guys talk about, like, oh, you know, always, you know, try this calling sequence. Try this, you know, if you're going to run decoys, this decoy set, or do this situation or whatever. And when someone tries, especially someone like myself, and they're like, hey, it didn't work for me. And then they instantly start thinking, they start second guessing what they're doing, lose self-confidence. And hunting's all about having self-confidence.
Oh, yeah.
Because if you can't hunt confident, dude, good luck.
Yep.
Good luck.
Yep, absolutely. And watching somebody that, you know, the strategies that they preach and then watching them go out there and employ them and not successful, then they have success using that strategy. You're like, it works. You just have to be persistent with it. You have to trust the system. You have to trust what you know. And like, you know, when you're green and you don't know any better, you're like, you automatically place fault on yourself. Like, I obviously didn't do something right because he done it and it worked. Well, that's because he only showed you the time that it worked.
Yep.
With these new kind of web-based shows and stuff, you get to see some of those failures, and it brings everything, like I said, it makes it more realistic. So,
when people want to show the failures, because I know some shows that they still just want to show the highlights, and that's fine if that's what you want to do for an entertainment factor, but you don't learn anything from that.
You don't learn anything
from it. It's just entertainment. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's like when you turn on the television and you're watching 12 or 15 birds die in one episode.
Yeah.
You cannot learn anything from that.
Yeah, yeah. Like, or those people are hunting property that the normal man can't put his feet on.
Yeah.
It is what it is. When you're hunting real scenarios and real places and real areas that, you know, you could go hunt, I could go hunt, anybody could go hunt, typically that's not the case, you know. So it's – we just tried to, with the Pinhoti Project, just tried to basically bring something realistic to viewers that they can watch that kind of sets the scene the same way it would be set if they were the one out there hunting it, you know, and some of the same dialogue you have with your good buddies, you know. You don't ever see this, you know, this pick at each other or aggravation, you know, all of that. None of that makes the fancy stuff, you know, the clean stuff. You don't ever see any of that aggravation.
Yeah.
Because everybody's like, ooh, you know, they're not happy with each other. Hey, that happens.
Yep.
You know, if, you know.
Well, so like, you know, kind of going back a little bit more about your background, what got you into hunting public land first?
Well, hunting public land was kind of the only option I had. You know, I never had any big family leases or family farms. We had a hunting club when I was growing up. My dad's a fanatical deer hunter. don't know why I picked up turkey hunting, but I did. Became just flat out infatuated with it and calling them and hunting them and learning them and just wanting to watch them, just like that's what I did. And yeah, I don't know what caused that, but as soon as that started, you know, that ball started rolling, it just mm-hmm. continues to build momentum. Like to this day, I'm still, when turkey season gets here, it's just like everybody tune out. Like don't mm-hmm. include Dave in anything because he's not going to be there. Like yep. it's just way it works. Yeah, public land and the way that I started turkey hunting was that hunting club we had bordered a chunk of public land. Mm-hmm. And I would go in through my hunting club and I'd be like, wow, that was 300 acres. And I could listen in two spots and listen to that 300 acres. Mm-hmm. So obviously I quickly began venturing off through the public land. And I figured out like, hey, you know, 300 acres isn't enough to entertain me for a morning turkey hunting. Mm-hmm. I need like 3,000 acres. And the only thing that can accommodate that kind of roaming is public land.
Yeah, exactly. And
that's exactly kind of like what gets us so fired up about hunting public land is I've been doing it now. This is my fifth year. This was my fifth year season hunting public land, pretty much the last 2 years exclusively for the most part. And it's one of those things that, to me, you learn so much more and become a better outdoorsman, key Southern outdoorsman, when you hunt public land. Just because you're learning stuff that if you went up to a private farm, say like a family farm, like give my example, mm-hmm. like when I was hunting my family farm, I didn't learn much of anything out there other than if patience. Deer was downwind of you, you'd they'd smell you.
Yeah.
And then patience. That's yeah. it. Yeah. That's all. Because you're not going out, you're doing different sets. I'm talking as a deer hunter now, but mm-hmm. still as a turkey hunter, you know, you're kind of doing the same old thing every time, and it's mm-hmm. just a repetition. And it becomes more of like you're trying to go to kill something instead of you're actually like hunting.
Yeah,
you're absolutely. Just
you're adapting. I mean, and any successful turkey hunter has got to adapt. Mm-hmm. You show me a successful turkey hunter that there's not one that's mm-hmm. not adaptable, that's not flexible, that's not can roll with the punches, cannot make the best out of a bad scenario. They can read what's going on. They can kind of, you know, their wheels will get to turn and they figure out what's going on and they kind of head it off at the pass. That's what makes a good turkey hunter is if you look going out there with your you know, with your book of laws or book of rules, and you think that you're going to employ do number one, do number two, do number three, and do number four, and there's going to be a turkey at the end of the book, and you're sadly mistaken. I don't think that happens very often. You've got to be able to think on your feet and adapt to the situation and make moves and strategic moves and calls and know where to be, play the weather. There's so much to it, like that puts you to that final, you know, the trigger pull. You know, there's so much into it that. It's not. It's more than choosing the right deer stand and being in the right spot that mm-hmm. day. Now, I know there's a lot that goes into deer hunting, too, with reading thermals and the way the wind blows and where the bucks are going to be on said day and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. And to me, deer hunting is more of a drawn-out thought process. Like, it's a thought process that goes many months worth of thinking and planning for a particular hunt to where turkeys are more like a day-by-day mm-hmm. battle. And that's what I like about it. I can, you know, meet a turkey at daylight, and regardless of whether it's a 6-hour duel or whether it's a 30-minute roost hunt that I was successful at, I still feel like we got to know each other in that short amount of time. Like there was the dialogue there. There was the me trying to think for him almost, you know, trying to get myself in the right position. Mm-hmm. So it was, I like those, that, you know, I could do it one day and I could be successful and I could turn around and do the same thing the next day, you know, to where if you're a deer hunter, you hunt one buck and when it all comes together, there you're done, yeah. You know.
Mm-hmm. No, exactly. Now, with you, the way you talk about turkey hunting, I've got to ask, have you ever elk hunted before?
One time, yeah.
It seems like that would be like your fire. It's like a giant turkey, man.
Yeah. My only thing with elk hunting would be is the after the kill thing. You know, turkey, I can throw it over my shoulder.
Yeah, 20 pounds.
I can get out of there, yep. And I can do it again the next day. You shoot an elk, and I'm, you know, there's days worth of cutting and packing.
Yeah.
I'd be ready to do it again, and I'd have to be cutting and packing, you know.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I have done it one time before. It was very enjoyable. Look forward to going back. What's kept me from doing that, you know, up to this point mm-hmm. is flexibility. I use everything I've got during the springtime. I don't usually have much wiggle room when it comes to having a week free during September. So,
how many days do you hunt during the springtime for turkeys?
This last year it was 75 mornings. It was 75 wake ups.
Golly. You know, Woo.
So, I'm jealous.
So like some of those are before work, of course. Yeah. But it's you know, this year you're looking at 90 from what I've got put up. So
I guess you're starting in Florida.
Yeah, next week. So the youth season's 23rd, and I'll be down there.
So. All right, man, you're getting a jump on it. No, next week. I'm jealous.
I always start first weekend in March in South Florida, so it's I chase it from there as far as I can chase it.
Okay. All right. This is one thing I would love to break down. It's kind of like regionally, like how you travel and then how you hunt regionally. Mm-hmm. When you're hunting South Florida, I went down there this past year and got my butt handed to me. Really, I didn't have much time to hunt. It was for work. Bought a license and everything. When I went down there, I was hunting big cypress. So I was talking to Shane about this. How different is it when you're going from hunting in Georgia to hunting South Florida, especially I don't know how south you go.
Yeah.
But how big of a transition period does it take for you to really get an idea of, you know, how the birds are using that territory? Because I was confused going out there looking for what I thought was oak hammocks turned out were cypress little swamps.
Dumps.
Yeah. And turns find out after talking to Shane, he's like, oh, well, that's where the birds are at. I'm like, well, I didn't think about that when I was there. I was like trying to find high ground. All the high ground was grass.
Yeah. It's a learning curve for sure. And it's a steep, painful learning curve down there. Know that you won't hunt any place in the world like South Florida. I mean, the turkeys are just, they live in stuff that our rabbits in Georgia would turn their back to. You know, I mean, they live in that thick stuff and stuff, you know, they're hunted by everything 365 days a year.
Mm-hmm.
You know turkeys. You know they got to have food and water and roost.
Mm-hmm.
And you know they prefer to have a little bit of an open to use their eyes. Their eyes are their main defense. So you just kind of, you know, just look for sign and you pick up what bits of information you can.
Mm-hmm.
And like South Florida, I quickly realized those turkeys live in the water. Like that, you know, if it's dry, then they're not comfortable. They live in the water. They like the water.
But
so
don't mind walking through water.
They live at the water's edge. That's where they get their food. They eat a lot of the crayfish and stuff that's in the water. So if you go around a cypress dome that's got water, you look around the edge of it, and that's where your turkey sign will be. So you learn stuff like that, you know. And those pine flats are good, but a lot of times they're choked with palmettos.
Yeah.
And they're so thick that, you know, you can't even walk through them. So therefore, turkeys aren't there, you know, nearly as much. And fire is such a big thing down there, because if something doesn't receive fire in a handful of years, then it's so thick that you can't beat your way through it with a machete. So you have to kind of rely on that. And then the water levels changes day to day down there. Mm-hmm. It's going to be a super, super wet year this year, it's looking like. So that always is added some rough challenges there, you know, dealing with the water. And you wade a lot. Keep wet feet. Everything from waist down will be wet for how many ever days you're down there, you know. So it's stuff like that you learn to deal with. But just everywhere, like I said, a turkey hunter has to be adaptable. And especially if you want to travel to turkey hunt and you want to turkey hunt different places, you know, you just got to learn to kind of visualize what they're going to need and where they're going to need to get it at.
Mm-hmm.
And realize that you need to put yourself in an area that everything that they need is in a small area or the smallest area available. You know, sometimes like out west, these turkeys may have to travel for miles for roost and then water. So, you know, you got to put yourself in those areas where they'll have all those necessities. Virtually across the country, as long as you know what turkeys need you can find them. And then every turkey's going to react, I won't say the same, but they're there for the same reason. They're breeding at that time of the year. They want hens. You're supposed to be a hen, so you got to present yourself in a way that it's going to fool him, or essentially what you got to do is just get in front of him.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, and sometimes that's just what you got to do.
Now, what sparked your love for hunting birds in, like, the mountainous areas, especially, like
– It's just where I cut my teeth. You know, mm-hmm. I've started in North Georgia, hunted, and still to me to this day, that's my favorite turkeys to hunt. I mean – I was just telling somebody the other day, like, I've hunted them in Missouri and Iowa, these 25-pound turkeys, and you put a 16-pound mountain turkey in front of me, and it's going to gobble, and it's going to shake the ground harder than any other turkey in the country. It just does. Like, you put them right over a ridge from you, and those jokers are drumming, and I don't know if it's the acoustics of the surrounding woods or the hollows or whatever, but, you know, something about them. I just love hunting them in the hardwoods and hunting them in the mountains.
Now, again, coming from I'm originally from Central Alabama, so you know, used to hunting in pines and stuff. We just scouted. I told you I moved to Atlanta area. We scouted some North Georgia
area public land for deer hunting, but also I was looking for turkeys while the guy I was with, he was more interested in deer, and found tons of sign, but everything's so open. What is your, I know you don't really ever use decoys for the most part, right?
I never do.
What's your tactic in hunting something like pretty wide open timber like that? What's like,
you just gotta use the terrain. Like, that's why I like hunting the mountains. I can really use the terrain. Put something between you and him and get as close as you possibly can. And it's super challenging when the woods are dead in early season. Mm-hmm. You don't have a lot of cover, but you got to just use that terrain. And it can take some, you know, several mornings to where this turkey's gobbling, but you just can't get in the right spot. And the biggest problem a lot of people have is if that turkey's gobbling, they've got to, even if they can't get in the right spot, they've got to call to him. You know, they've got to, you know, have that. I don't provoke turkeys. If I know that I can't get in the spot to kill them, then I don't mess with them. Mm-hmm. You know, I may work myself to death trying to get into that spot. Mm-hmm. But like, you know, we just talked about hunting before work. If I don't have time, then I'm there the next morning hoping he's in that same mood and I'm going to approach him from a different area. But using that terrain, rolls in the ridges, bottoms, we have a lot of those little steeper but shorter, you know, ridges to mm-hmm. where you can get in the bottom and get past them almost if you need to, because that roll in the ridge will hide their eyes, you know, hide them. And then just, you know, you've got to be, it's really hard mm-hmm. if you have a turkey that's roosted and he flies down, he can see 200 yards and you're sitting there yelping at him and he's like, he's going to smell a rat real quick.
So he's like, where you at?
Well, I was going to say, for the most part, you don't want to be on top of those ridges if you can see super far, because you're going to be screwed.
Yeah, you're going to be screwed. Yeah, you need to, you know, play the game to where when he comes up, he's in shotgun range or dang near it, you know.
Okay. Well, that's something smart, because that's while I was out there, I was like, man, you could, like, if someone wanted to shoot 300 yards of a rifle, you could do it in some of these spots.
Yeah.
I'm like, how are you and there's turkey sign everywhere. I'm like, how in the heck, early, like you said, early season, are you going to sneak in there and be able to kind of get one within shot?
What's really, I mean, the really important thing there is to realize where they're going.
Yeah.
Learn the turkeys and realize where they're going, mm-hmm. because we'll find a lot of turkeys early season will stay down in the bottoms because they're flying up. They've got hens right with them. Mm-hmm. So you'll hear those turkeys and you'll hear them gobbling. You'll hear them fly down, and all of a sudden you can't hear them anymore because they've fallen into a bottom, because those hens want to get in those creek bottoms where it greens up quickest. And if you know that they're most likely going to be heading to the creek bottom because they already have hens with them, if you can beat them there, mm-hmm. Then you've, you know, basically, you know, won the game.
Yeah.
So if you read that, but if you take that typical turkey hunter, let's get above him approach, then you're going to be sitting there by yourself most of the morning. So it's learning turkeys and where they're going to go before they get there. That's that whole process of learning turkeys and what they need. The hens are, I feel like hens just kind of breed on the side. They're always worried about food and mm-hmm. what they're going to eat next, and the gobblers are always around, so the breeding's available whenever it's convenient for them, you know. Mm-hmm. And the food is what's always driving them, so as long as you can beat them to wherever they're going, like I said, a lot of times early season it's creek bottoms, or if there's an old logging road with some native grasses along the edges of it,
you know, where getting there. Sun
getting it's sun cool. Some grasses so that those bugs will be there, so if you can beat them there, then mm-hmm. almost guessing where they're going to be just based on where they're roosting. So, oh, they're roosting here. I know they like here. So you kind of beat them there. Because a lot of times it can be impossible to get 100 yards from them on the roost. It's dead out.
Yeah.
You know, they can see it forever. Leaves are loud.
I was going to say, unless it was rainy, overcast, and you could slip in there while it was, mm-hmm. like, just soaking wet. I mean, mm-hmm. there's no way. But that's kind of interesting because, again, I've never had experience hunting something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So it's going to be kind of interesting to see how tactics change going into a habitat like that and seeing how it plays out. Especially, like, you know, if you also were hunting up in, like, you know, East Tennessee, probably be the same thing.
Yep.
Which is kind of interesting as well as, you know, hearing guys that hunt in those areas. And kind of like what you're saying, like, it's like always using topography to your advantage. I mean, are you running, like, Onyx or any kind
Onyx,
of?
Onyx, yeah.
Yeah, just topo map.
Maps. And, you know, I'm a big topo map, just a freak.
Well, you got to be in that territory.
I've got a pile of – I still like to have the old waxy maps just to look at sometimes. But, yeah, Onyx has really changed the game with your ability to just flip back and forth and look at satellite and, mm-hmm. and whatever. But, yeah, usually 9 out of 10 times mine's on the topo feature, you know. And I'm like – because I love looking at those contour lines and figuring out where I need to get them. And stuff before they do. So we use it a lot.
That's pretty slick.
Yep.
Again, probably not a whole bunch of turkey hunters are looking at a topo map while they're trying to get on some birds.
Yeah.
I don't know many that are.
Yeah, it's constantly. If I'm on the move, I'm looking at that thing. Because, you know, spine ridges and finger ridges and bottoms, I mean, that is the whole game. Mm-hmm. I mean, you've got to use that to your advantage. If you don't, woods turkeys will whoop you every day because you've got to be where they want to be no matter what mood they're in. Mm-hmm. If you're not where they want to go or a place that they're comfortable going, you can sit there and yelp your brains out and they'll gobble and you know, not be there. You've got to be able to read those topo maps and put yourself in a spot that he wants to be.
Yeah.
Location, 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 it'll always be king.
Now, I got a question for you. Again, this is coming from a new hunter, so I'm trying to learn as much as I can. Is how much time are you putting to actually, like, on-the-ground scouting, either before season, or are you doing a lot of stuff where, like, you just have histories in areas where you know there's going to be birds, and you kind of go there, and you kind of get a feel the morning you're hunting them of what they're kind of doing?
Well, I mean, like I said, I travel a lot, and a lot of times I'm putting my feet on ground that I've never been to. Mm-hmm. I do a lot of, if that's the case, I do a lot of internet scouting. I mm-hmm. do a lot of pin dropping. I kind of know the area before I even get there. So I've got a starting point. I've got a point A that I want to hit. I've got from there, I want to go here. I want to go here. So I've almost got my day mapped out before I get there.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of that, but, you know, the unknown is kind of what drives me. I love hunting unfamiliar stuff. I love because my whole reason to getting into traveling turkey hunter is I love turkeys and I love interacting with them. And it got to where I wanted to interact with them in different terrains and different, you know, landscapes and habitats and stuff. And that's what kind of drove me to hunt areas of a state that may not be as popular, but they offered something, you know, terrain-wise, that was unique.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I love Florida so much. You can't hunt anywhere in the country that's more unique than Florida. You go down there, you hear like a billion bird species at daylight, and you're like, what? You know, everywhere else, you know what that is. Oh, yeah. That's a pileated woodpecker. Oh, that's a barred owl. Oh, that's a whippoorwill. Oh, that's a, mm-hmm. you know, whatever. But you go down there, and I'm like, I don't know what that was. You know?
Yeah.
You're like, what was that? I don't know. You know?
When I was down there at Big Cypress, that's exactly what it was like. It was like all these birds. I was like, holy, like, what the heck is that? And walking through these big gates and everything, everything high fenced off because of
the Panthers.
Animals. Yeah.
Yep.
Dude.
But
he was freaked out in Big Cypress.
I'm telling you,
buddy, when you jump down in that place and for your first time, first time I ever set foot in it, I was like 18 or 19 years old. I was a freshman in college. You know, I drove down there and then walked off into that place and I mean, it is an eye-opener.
And you can get turned around so easy.
So easy. Everything's like this tall. And
yeah. Well, see, like, and I'm so good. I feel like back in, like, any kind of, like, wood country, hill country, I'm pretty good at, like, knowing direction. Even if it's overcast, can I get a good idea of, you know, north, south, east, and west, how mm-hmm. I came in. Down there, I tried that before I pulled Onyx out. Dude, I got probably half a mile from the car, and I started looking around. I was like, is that tree – like, what tree line did I come from? And then it all looks the same. I start walking. I'm like, oh, I got to pull the app out.
Yeah.
Like, it's ridiculous. So, that's definitely – I can see that being an intimidating factor for somebody. So, you're going to Florida first. What's the next couple of states you're going to be hitting, I guess?
I'm a little bit unstructured this year because I'm going to have a lot of flexibility that I haven't had in the past. But, yeah, to start in Florida, like always, because that's what starts earliest, and I'll work my way up through, you know, Georgia and Alabama. We're going to go over to South Carolina, going over to Arkansas – possibly Louisiana. That's in the mix, and then I'm gonna probably come back across because I like hunting. Like I said, I like hunting woods turkeys. I like hunting hardwoods turkeys,
mm-hmm.
And I'll probably go back maybe toward like North Carolina, Virginia, West Virginia, and then swing up through maybe Ohio, Indiana, and then we're gonna make an out west trip. You know, not really 100% sure where that's gonna be yet, but mm-hmm. probably thinking a lot about Black Hills. I hadn't been there in many years, and while the bird numbers aren't what they used to be, it'd be, you know, a fun experience getting back in there. I haven't been, like I said, in a handful of years to hunt that area. You know, who knows? I'm just going to leave the book open, and if anybody calls me and says, hey, man, the turkeys are hot, we're getting some good weather, then I'll probably have the truck packed and on my way. So
that's awesome.
Now, one thing we failed to mention is that you've killed a turkey in all 49 states that have turkeys.
I have.
Oh, yeah, really?
I have, yeah.
I didn't know that.
You didn't know that?
I did not know that until just now.
Yep.
I'm
yep.
embarrassed, but hey, that's awesome, though. Holy yep. cow, dude.
Yeah, that bug hit me, that traveling turkey hunt bug, and then it got to where I was like, well, I haven't been here yet.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
What was killing a turkey in Hawaii like?
Unique is what it was like. Yeah, you're hunting volcanoes out there, dormant volcanoes and stuff. Jeez. And, you know, they brought them over there. They're not native, but they're mm-hmm. – pile of them, and it was fun.
Rios?
Rios, and it's public land. There's some public land out there you can drag your feet on, and it's rugged. I mean, it is some ankle-twisting stuff, but, yeah.
Jurassic Park.
It was fun. It was a lot of fun. Yeah, it was an experience.
That's one I always wonder about, man. What were you about to ask?
No, I was going to say, what was the time frame? How long, like, from the time you took it seriously? Because I know some guys, you can bounce around from a couple states just for the heck of it, kind of like what we were doing. But from the time you took it seriously to the time you finished, how long did that take?
I think it was 7 years.
Wow.
Yeah, because I got started, like, obviously I was like, you know, Grand Slam, I want to kill a Grand Slam. Yep. Then I killed a Grand Slam. Like, oh, I want to kill a Grand Slam in one season. And then I killed a single season Grand Slam. And then I was like, well, what's next? You know, at that time I'd only killed in four states. I'd killed in four for the Grand Slam. And I was like, well, I'm going to start on this U.S. Slam. You know, Tom Weddle, I don't know if you guys know him, but he's like done it three times now. Like he's just a beast.
God,
you know, and I kept up with him and we kind of kept up with each other. And he's the only person that I had known. I'm pretty sure he had completed it at that time. I'm not 100%, but I knew that's what he did. And I thought, that's what I want to do. I want to try something like that. So I just started at that point. Every year I would map out. I wanted to do, at first I was like, I want to make sure I get four new states a year. You know, but then, of course, that ballooned into I hunt eight states, new states this year, and then I hunt 13 new states this year. So, you know, it took seven years.
Yeah, I'm trying to think about this. Like, how? Dude, that's a lot.
This is an audio show, so people can't see Jacob. Yeah, like, I'm over dumbfounded.
Here. Yeah, I'm almost over here. Like, I wish I had a camera right now. Dude, that's crazy.
Yeah, it's fun.
Yeah.
You know,
it's kind of
taken off, and everybody – seems like everybody I talk to now that's killed the turkey in five states is now chasing the U.S. Slam, and that's cool. And I hope it's, you know, in some way tied to what I've been able to bring out with the Pinhoti Project and traveling and what's really possible, because I felt like a lot of people really loved a turkey hunt, and they didn't do anything besides what was in their home state. Yeah. They didn't know how obtainable it was just to go across the state line and hunt turkeys on unfamiliar ground. Like – I've done it. I've seen success doing it. I'm nobody special. I don't do anything that anybody else can't do. Like, it's obtainable for anybody. Mm-hmm. You know, even if you have a family, if you've got a 5-day, 6-day vacation that you can take, I mean, it's not expensive. You know, it's usually the expense that, you know, I'm not a six-figure man. I'm not, you know, some office guy that's making piles of money and, you know, maxing out 401ks and all this kind of craziness. Mm-hmm. I'm just a dude that has figured out a way to do it very cheap. You know, I live out of the back of my truck. Like, there's a cot in the back of my truck with a cooler, heater, fan, sleeping bag, pillow. I sleep wherever I slow down. And you can do this for basically tags and gas, you know. And anybody can do it. And I just hope that anybody that sees my stuff is like, you know what? And I've had, you know, a number of people now send me messages or emails like, man, because of what you did, I'm going to go hit two new states this year. I've never done. Is this something I should consider? Mm-hmm. Well, by all means, but go out there for the experience. Go out there because you're going to be doing something you love in somewhere that's completely new. Like, you know, get comfortable being uncomfortable is what I say. It's like live out of the back of the truck or live in the – I mean, for years I slept in the front seat of my truck. I just lay that thing back and that's where we slept. You know?
Have done that?
And it's obtainable, man. It's not expensive. You don't have to go buy it. It's not going to cost you $100, $75 to $100 a night for a room. You don't have to go with an outfitter and pay them, you know, $2,000 or whatever for a three-day hunt. Like, you can do this stuff for the cost of tags. Like, you can do, gosh, so many states.
Well, let's break that down for, you know, people that are listening right now and listeners. If someone wanted to do, say, just one out-of-state hunt, or maybe they want to do a couple states this spring, how could – kind of break it down to them, like kind of how you do it, but how can someone save money so all they're focused on is hunting and they're not tied up about, you know, like hotels and everything else? Like, how do you break it down to try to make it as cost-efficient as possible but also as doable where they're not, I guess –
First off, you can, as far as cost efficiency, you can shop around the states because states, you know, some are expensive states. Some, it's all depending what you want to do and how much time you have. Like state of Alabama, for instance, it's extremely expensive to buy a year-long license for the state of Alabama. Mm-hmm. But they allow you to kill five turkeys. So how much time do you have to devote to killing those five turkeys? You can go to a turkey that's less expensive that they may only allow you to kill three turkeys. But if you're only hunting for 5 days, you're doing pretty doggone good. You kill three turkeys in 5 days. So that may be something that you want to, you know, that may save you $100 to hunt that state. You know, like I just mentioned, like lodging is always a super expensive thing. Like all over the country, even in the littlest, rattiest little town out there, it's still going to cost you at least $60-$75 a night. And you consider you stay there for 5 nights, that's a considerable amount of money, you know. So I always, like, I've got a cot set up in the back of my truck. I've got a truck with a cap on it, you know, the little cap. And I've got a shelf built you know, I sleep on that cot. I mean, I sleep better there than I do at home. I mean, it's just, it is home. And I sleep out, I mean, I eat out of a cooler. I mean, I've got sandwich meat. I've got deer that I killed during the fall. I mean, I've got all of this, you know, prepared. I carry a little camp stove or a single burner stove, whichever one I decide to use that day. I mean, I've got like a little buddy heater in there that I can pop on if I'm in there somewhere that it's cold to make it comfortable. I mean, try to get as comfortable as you can. But, you know, you just get comfortable, you know, sleeping in those areas. It's super convenient. You save trip time going, driving into town. You, you know, everything's right there at your fingertips, basically, where all you have to worry about is turkey hunting. I mean, you go out, you turkey hunt for however long you want to turkey hunt. And as soon as you get back to your truck, it's time to take a nap, go to sleep, wake up and do it again the next morning. And literally you have the gas that it costs you to get there, the tags, and what very little expense it cost you at the grocery store to buy sandwich meat, loaf of bread, some trail mix, some granola bars, and a case of waters.
Yeah.
You know, but you got to be one of those people that's comfortable not going in and having a steak, you know, a couple times a week. You got to be comfortable, you know, not, you know, having, you know, some fine wine or something.
Yeah. I mean, you're roughing it. And that's the thing. You're doing this for the experience.
I'm trading the comfort for more tags, essentially. Like, I could afford to do that stuff, but you may have to break it down and only go to one hunting trip if you live like that, to where I could take that same amount of money, go on three. You know, the experiences are more important to me than the plush living.
Yeah, and it's really intimidating until you do it. Where we went to Wyoming and hunted mule deer a couple years ago, and we did, I mean, we slept in the truck most nights, or we camped most nights. We had like lunch meat, granola bars, like protein bars. And I mean, we did it extremely cheap compared to what most people spend on a Western hunt, like dirt cheap.
Yeah. And like Doc, the guy I just mentioned, he calls it the poor man's big game. You can hunt turkeys, you know, turkey tags are considerably less expensive than any kind of big game out west. You try to kill an elk or something, the tag by itself's $500 or $600 or $700 bucks. You know, that's about three states worth of turkey tags, even in, you know, pretty expensive states, even about $200 you can usually get into some turkey tags. So man, you can go turkey hunt $500. I can go somewhere on it, I can promise you.
Yeah.
You know, and that's what I'm saying. Why I call it obtainable. Like anybody, usually over the course of a year, you sit back, you know, a little bit out of each paycheck. By the time spring rolls around, you can have $1,000. Man, you can go hunt 2-3 states on $1,000, all depending on how far you want to go from home.
Yeah.
And as long as you do it like, you know, how I like to do it, you can do it. And it's the time. It's always the biggest deal. It's always the time.
We've talked about that all the time when we talk about hunting out west. Is, you know, there's so many guys that just want to go on these different trips. They want to go hunt elk. They want to go hunt turkeys in other states. They want to do all these other things. But they're like, it's normally not – they always like, oh, it's too expensive. It's normally not the money. That's not the issue. It's the time.
Absolutely.
Time away from family, time away from their job, time away from whatever. And once you can kind of – I'm not going to say get over it. Once you can kind of – break out of that norm and be like, hey, I'm going to go do it. I'm going for this experience. And you kind of see it's really doable. You're like, you can put back time for it.
After Wyoming, we're like, that's easy.
Yeah. Like, I mean, and not to get all super, you know, sappy, but like, you've got one go at this thing. And if it's something that you really want to do, I've never been one of these, like, I'll do it next year, one of these days kind of people. Like, I'm like, if I want to do it and it is at all obtainable, then I'm going to do it. Because I don't know if tomorrow's here. I don't know if next year's here. Like, I'm not one of these, like, my thing is I always say one of these days, I've not found a calendar with one of these days on it. That joker is Monday through Sunday and always will be. So if one of these days is just, there's not a date. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I mean, you've got to, if you want to do something bad enough, you'll put it into motion. You'll start getting those wheels turning and – I don't know, turkey hunting appeals to me so much because it is so obtainable. Like, it is so easy to do. And like you said, once you do it once, you're like,
hey, you realize
that wasn't that hard. You know, that is, and then it's just like, it's like a drug. You do it one time, you're like, ooh, I need more of that. Ooh, I need more of that. Next thing you know, like I said, you're hunting a dozen states a year.
Yeah.
And you're wide open and you're, you know, figuring out you're changing jobs that's going to give you more time off, or you're changing jobs because it doesn't make you come into lunch. You know, you're doing things that – and it's just to feed that obsession because, you know, like I said, you know, you only get one go at this life thing. So, you know.
That's true, man. That's true. And if you wait around, you know, it'll leave you, because my dad was like that, and a lot of people in his generation were like, Now, one day I'm going to go. My dad always wanted to do an elk hunt. He passed away at an early age. He never got to go do
never
any
got
of that.
To do an elk hunt.
See, he got to go to Kentucky three times, killed two nice whitetails in Kentucky, and then I got to be like 10 or so, and he quit doing that, and he was going to get back into it probably, you know, when I got up in my teenage years.
So you could join him, yeah.
Yeah, and he didn't make it till then.
Yeah.
And he never got to do any of that stuff.
Exactly.
And I know a lot of his friends that are still around who still haven't done any of that stuff because they've always said.
One of them days, one of these days hasn't showed up on that calendar yet.
Yeah.
You know? And I'm like, every day that you get older, you're not getting more healthy.
Yep.
You know what I'm saying? I mean, everybody's like, I can't wait till I retire. I'm like, retire? Like, man, when I retire, my knees might be gone. Like, I want to do this stuff while my body will let me climb those mountains or do 14-mile days or wade 2 miles into Big Cypress or do this stuff because I'm afraid once I get the time, I won't have the physical ability.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the most haunting thing to me, to want to do something and not be able to do it because of your physical limitations.
Yeah.
Like, that haunts me. So I'm like, I might have to work till I'm 80, but I'm going to have the experiences while my body will let me to do the things that I want to do, you know.
So yeah, that's like Jamie and Andrew Monahan. They waited till a little bit later in life to start going out west to elk hunt, which they're not old, but they waited till, you know, later, and they get out there and they do it once. They're like, why didn't we start doing this 20 years ago?
20 years ago, this would have been just been even more enjoyable.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, Dave, one thing I want to talk to you about is, you know, you're so passionate about turkey hunting. What sparked that? I know you said you kind of got turkey hunting when you were younger, but really what was the defining factor that got you, like, hooked to the point you are today?
Yeah, I guess I really don't have a definite answer for that.
Yeah.
I mean, I started, like I said, my dad was a fanatical deer hunter, and I was in the woods, and I learned that woodsmanship by Lord. I mean, we were rambling through the woods with pellet guns when we were little. Poor songbirds and gray squirrels, nothing had a chance, you know. Kids don't do that anymore, I don't think, but that's just what we did. And I think I learned a lot of those, like, woodsmanship skills at that age, and I was, once I got old enough to hunt turkeys, like I said, it was that day-to-day strategy or, like, war that you played. It was always, everybody was like a chess match making moves, and I got to do that. It changed every day. Like, it wasn't the same game from yesterday.
Yeah.
Like, and that was so fresh in the dialogue. I mean, I've always been one of those kids that when I heard something, I wanted to mimic it. You know, I could hear an owl, and I could do it with my mouth in just 10 minutes. I could hear it in my ears, and I could, for some reason, mimic that and do it. You know, I've always been one of those kids like, oh, Dave can make that sound.
Yeah.
You know, he can do the sound of that. You know, I've always been, you know, in conversation and having them talk back and forth to you, and we'll never know what they're saying. We like to pretend like, oh, she's yelping because she's lost, but we really don't know what she's saying. Obviously she's lost, but you've got to see their body language to really relay that. But still, it's fun thinking that you're talking to them and attempting to manipulate that.
Yeah.
And I think that little bit of being able to have your handle on something, like handle something without it knowing it.
Yeah.
And having something show up expecting something so different. Like when you call that gobbler in, he's expecting you to be a little 8-pound genie sitting there, and he doesn't have a clue. You've just fooled something that is hunted by everything literally for its whole life. And when you convince it to throw all of that to the wind, I don't know. There's just something that's special about it to me. I mean, you've really just – that's the pinnacle for me.
Well, for any of our listeners that cannot tell, Dave is extremely passionate about this. If you cannot tell in his voice by how he talks about this. And you're true. I mean, one thing that kind of got me re-fired up about turkey hunting was, like, hunting with him, starting hunting with him in, like, 2015 or 16 on some public land and getting birds within range. Because before that, I'd never really had any experience with – you know, Tom strutting in front of me, you know, listening, getting in different situations of how you would handle them and learn very quickly. Still am learning to this day, you know, how to handle different situations. But it's like the whole fact of you're calling an animal and you're trying to fool the animal with a sound to get him to come within range.
What's really crazy about that is you're fooling his ears, which are his secondary defense. You know, he trusts his eyes so much. You're getting that turkey to almost ignore his number one defense for survival and trust his ears over his eyes, which he's lived by his whole life. So that's why I'm so I'm not anti-decoy by any stretch of imaginations, but that's why I don't use them, because I like fooling a turkey. I like fooling a turkey's ears. Yeah. I like fooling a turkey without using any type of visual stimulus, because I don't like taking advantage of their reliance on that visual. You know, using their eyes as a defense. Mm-hmm. I don't like manipulating that. I like almost making them ignore that, mm-hmm. and convincing them and trusting something that's number two in line when it comes to, you know, safety, mm-hmm. and you know, trusting that enough to put themselves in harm's way.
Yeah, no, you're 100% right. And, you know, that was a topic that I wanted to talk about, was, you know, just decoys, because I know you don't use them. And, you know, growing up, and we talked to Shane about this too earlier, is, you know, kind of starting out, that was our crutch.
Mm-hmm.
100%.
Yeah, absolutely.
Crutch. Oh, like, you didn't use them because it was, like Shane says, it's a tool if you want to use them. No, that was a crutch. Like, mm-hmm. you used them, and you were hoping the turkey saw the decoys before they saw anything else.
Yep.
After hunting publicly and having some weird situations with other hunters and mm-hmm. is not wanting to carry them around and this and that, I decided, like, screw the decoys. And just, mm-hmm. like you said, instead of using topography, mostly using vegetation to try to
get them. Same deal. Something to hide them.
Yeah, get them to come within a certain range so when they pop out, you know, they're mm-hmm. right there. But, you know, where did your passion now come from, again, trying to fool their ears more so than their eyes? Because, mm-hmm. you know, decoys are as popular as, you know, every mouth call out there. So what made you want to kind of go away from the norm? Well, I'm not even say the norm, but let's kind of almost go more old school with
traditional,
it.
It's more of a traditional approach. I've got to be careful. You got a tenderfoot around these type of subjects, because I don't want to come off as a purist, somebody that hates everybody that doesn't do it his way. Because virtually, if it's legal, have at it, swing the bat. As long as you're going, it's better than not going. But I like, I don't know. It's decoys take away those. In most cases, it can, obviously everything comes with variances, mm-hmm. but decoys take away those most important steps, in my opinion. You can convince a turkey, blah, 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 but once they get into that, you know, that hand-to-hand combat, that within 100 yards, the setups that are so – the decisions you make to make those last 75 yards a thing, mm-hmm. All of those decisions and strategies and tactics that you have to employ to make sure that 75 yards – is covered by him, mm-hmm. Or basically thrown out the window. I mean, decoys take care of that for you.
Yeah.
And so you're basically just taking a lot of that game, mm-hmm. And just throwing it out the window. Like you can negate it. So in my opinion, you're missing something. If he's got to die, as you can tell, I'm passionate about it. I love him. I absolutely love him. And if he's got to die, if he has to become a lump of, you know, meat and feathers, I want him to have provided me with as much as he possibly could. Mm-hmm. I wanted him to given me everything that he possibly could. And I feel like when I fool him into shotgun range without using any of those visual stimuluses and stuff, without skipping any of those steps that got him there, then I've gotten that.
Yeah.
When he gets to 80 yards and he sees a decoy, and like I said, he trusts his eyes more than anything else, and he just throws everything to the wind. Mm-hmm. It just feels dirty to me. It's just not right to me. Not right. It's not for me.
Yeah, no, hey, it's fine.
I've done it. I mean, I've killed turkeys in about every way you can possibly imagine. Because I've came from that crowd that was younger getting into this. I haven't been doing it for 40 years like some of these guys. So I learned through baby steps with all the advancements in technology. I was running around with a strutting decoy that I made out of an Osceola I killed in Florida, stretched it around an old archery target, and we were killing the mess out of turkeys with this rotten cape around and it didn't take me long killing a handful of them over it. I was like, this ain't right.
Yeah.
Something don't feel right here. You know, a turkey comes out in a pipeline right away 400 yards away with 15 hens, and he leaves all 15 hens and comes running to your – that feels dirty. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't know. It just I didn't feel right about it. And it quickly became, you know, this is a strategy thing. The short answer to the question that you asked me was decoys just changed the game in a way that I don't like.
Yeah.
Like, they changed the game – something that I'm not comfortable doing. Like, I'm not going to look down on somebody for doing it, but to me, it just feels a little bit icky.
Yeah, no, and that's totally fine. And one thing that I stopped using decoys for the aspect of where I was hunting, it didn't make sense because I'm hunting vegetation like in pines mm-hmm. and stuff. If you can see the bird, he's within shotgun mm-hmm. range.
Yeah.
Like, if he can see you,
that's the strategy.
Yeah.
That's what you've got to make happen.
So it's like, and I was, again, starting out, you know, I had those little foam decoys you get from like Walmart.
Flex,
yeah. Oh, man. And I had like two of those bad boys in my vest all the time. I'd lose them all the time. Yep. And I'm like, after the fact, I was like, I don't even like use these half the time. Why am I even carrying them? Like, it's just pointless.
Yeah. But I hate having to crawl out there and get it when you're having to like reset up on one.
Oh, yeah.
I'm like, oh, I hope he can't see this decoy.
Well, it's like it's kind of the same thing. Like, when I started using this tactic, talking about using vegetation and terrain for deer hunting, mm-hmm. that if that deer pops out, he's within bow range, mm-hmm. okay? Do the same thing for turkeys, and it can play out for you. But, again, I was just thinking, like, you know, guys that are hunting, you know, like, what's – when you're hunting – a give example. Like, if you're hunting out in Kansas, you're hunting big ag, or you're just hunting open areas, how much – how does your calling sequence change or anything? How do you call in a situation where it's wide open – and that bird has to come and commit from a very long distance if you're not using decoys. Like, how do you play that?
I still use terrain. Like, yeah. even in the most wide open, flattest terrain, mm-hmm. there's ditches and there's slight elevations. You only need like a foot of elevation to hide yourself as long as you get down on your belly and can get dirty.
You see this?
Yeah.
I mean, like a foot and a half, 2 feet, okay. Anyway.
I still use terrain. A lot of it can be you learn where they're roosting, yeah. and you use cover of darkness because mm-hmm. no matter how flat it is, it still gets dark,
yep.
you know. And I'll use cover of darkness and close the distance. I'll put myself in the right spot. Mm-hmm. You know, I use grass. People will be amazed at what little – turkeys trust their eyes. But as long as you move strategically, you can get away, you know, mm-hmm. big chubs. My buddy that's in the Pinhoti Project with yeah. me quite a few, that dude's like 6'4". Like, he ain't no little boy. And you wouldn't believe some of the sneaks that I've watched him put on turkeys. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can use the smallest bit of terrain mm-hmm. to get yourself within shotgun range. And I've heard that, you know, you don't hunt turkeys in wide open places. You don't obviously hunt a bunch of big fields. You'd be a decoy user. Man, I've got videos to prove, you know, you can call a turkey across wide open field yelping at him. Mm-hmm. You know, you just put yourself in the right position and don't give them too much.
Mm-hmm.
The biggest thing is get them interested and shut up.
Yeah.
If you keep yelping at them and they're looking across a wide open field, of course. But if you get their attention and then you shut up and keep them thinking,
mm-hmm.
they're like, the curiosity will kill them.
Now, does that change? I've got to interrupt you right there. Does that change between the subspecies? Like, when it comes to, like, calling? Because I've heard, again, I've not hunted Rios, Merriams, or Osceolas, but I've heard, you know, Rios and Merriams are a little more active bird, and I've just heard that, you know, calling, you got to be even more aggressive, just more consistent.
Everything does, you know, alter back to those necessities that they need.
Mm-hmm.
Turkeys do everything for a reason. They're mm-hmm. just not out there wandering around.
Yeah,
they're on a path to do something. They're accomplishing something with every step that they take. The reason people think that about Merriams and Rios is because their necessities are usually over a wider amount of terrain. You know, Easterns can literally live within 70, 80 acres and have everything they need. Rios, a lot of times, will have to go a mile to find water, you know, and it's like arid or something. You know, they have to travel a long, huge distances mm-hmm. to get all of those resources that they need. So people think that about turkeys or Rios or the Western birds because they do move so much. I mean, you've really got to call to locate them because, I mean, you hit them one time. By the time you get set up, they'll be 300 yards further because their legs never stop moving. They don't do much standing still. They strut wide, you know, full sprint. They'll be strutting wide. You know, they act a little different for sure. But yeah, I mean, that's in Merriams, Rios, they get that reputation of anybody can kill one. You can mm-hmm. go out there, they gobble so much. They do gobble a lot, you know, because a lot of times they're trying to call up hens from a lot larger area. You mm-hmm. know, they're calling in hens because everything's spread out. You know, mm-hmm. think of your Easterns here and on the east side and just take that and just bust them up like to cover the same amount of turkeys covering 10 times the area. That's kind of like what they're dealing with. Mm-hmm. So they're gobbling a lot more because they're having to work a lot harder to get those hens because those hens are a lot further away. Mm-hmm. And they do gobble a lot more just by subspecies too, I believe. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't make them easy by any stretch. I've had Miriams whip me just as bad as any eastern bird has. Mm-hmm. I think it's comical when I hear people say, oh, those Miriams, you can call them up by slapping two boat pedals together. They hadn't hunted Miriams enough. You know, they've been out there once or twice, and they went with, you know, 7J Outfitters or Trophy Ridge Outfitters somewhere out in Wyoming or you know, the Dakotas or Montana or something, and they brought them in there to a place that they've know the birds are. They pre-scouted them. They've watched them. They know they go to this alfalfa field every day. And sure, if they're at point A and they're going to point B and they set you up in point B, you're going to think you're the world's greatest caller because you're going to yelp and they're going to run to you. Well, they were going that way anyway.
Yeah.
You know, and this dude that set you down there knew that. Mm-hmm. But they're like anything else. I mean, Miriam turkeys can be a curse, man. They can be, because there's the biggest difference between Miriam turkeys and Eastern turkeys. Mm-hmm. Eastern turkeys gobble at you probably because he's interested in what you just said. A Miriam turkey will gobble at you and not have any interest whatsoever. He can gobble at you and be going the other way at 100 miles an hour, and he'll gobble at you just the same. Mm-hmm. So just because you get a Miriam turkey to gobble, you get all excited and get set up, and he gobbles and he's 200 yards. He gobbles and he's 400 yards. He gobbles and he's 600 yards. And you're just sitting there scratching your head like, Eastern turkeys won't do that. They just won't gobble at you. So you can go on to the next one and not ever have to fool with him because he wasn't interested, and those Miriams, they'll gobble at you. And then the next thing you know, you'll be trying to chase him, and the last thing you want to do is try to chase a Miriam turkey. They will outrun you 10 times out of 10. So,
well, okay, then just real quick, what's your calling tactics or your hunting tactics for Miriams? If they're calling –
strike a bunch.
And just hope you get one
strike
lucky?
Strike a bunch. You get about one out of every 10.
Yeah.
You'll find in a good mood, and you can call him in and kill him. But, you know –
that's a good tactic to remember.
You know, those birds, they do gobble, you know, so keep moving. Coyote howling, elk bugling, like you mentioned earlier, cutting on a long box, whatever. Keep moving. Keep striking them. Like I said, one out of every seven, one that's out of every 10, you'll strike one and he's in the mood, you know, to act right. And you can roost those turkeys easy. They gobble a lot because they're, you know, they're looking for hens and gobbling a lot and like I said, they're gobbling a lot. They're trying to cover all that terrain and coyote howling late at night and putting a pen on birds and then shrinking that gap, you know, before daylight using the cover of darkness. And instead of trying to get up to him from a mile away, you know, you can be 150 from him off the roost. And you know, that he's the pen in the center of that circle. The smaller you make that circle, the harder it's going to be for him to get out of shotgun range. So
also, I mean, when you're hunting out there, I guess you can – have situations where you're probably dealing with some pretty big flocks in some situations.
If you go early season, you better believe it, you know. Yeah. And there's another a friend of mine who went out there and hunted, and I remember him calling me. He's like, man, did you not have – I mean, we couldn't get on them much because they had hens. I was like, man, we ain't killed a turkey yet that didn't have hens. You got to figure out how to kill them with hens. Mm-hmm. You know, it ain't always a sit down behind with your back against a tree and yelp them up and kill them, shoot them in the face running in there looking at you, you know. They gobble a lot for reasons, you know, number of reasons, but that goblin can be just a beacon. Like, okay, he's here now. Okay, well, if he went from here to here, I bet if I get here, he's going to keep his line of travel, you know. And you do that three or four times, and you luck up and get in his way, essentially. So a lot of that Miriam hunting, in my experience, is not your stereotypical sit-down, yelp them up stuff. Well, but at the end of the day, it still makes a pretty picture.
Oh, yeah, no, it's beautiful country. It's beautiful country out there. Well, I know we're getting probably close to time, probably right around an hour right now.
Hit it right on the head.
Well, I was going to say, let's touch a little bit on what's going on this weekend.
Okay.
Before we do that, before we start closing stuff out, I still want to ask you some stuff about some of your videos and some hunts that I've watched. First of all, this goes back a little bit to getting people to like travel to hunt turkeys on public land specifically, because you have like the roadblock of cost and everything. They're like, oh, it's too expensive, I don't have time. And then the next roadblock after that is, oh, it's public land, like pressure is going to be terrible. And my favorite one of yours that I've seen so far is, I don't remember where y'all were, might have been Georgia or Alabama, but y'all set up on this turkey and you were filming him on the roost, mm-hmm. and he was gobbling, and then a guy drives up.
Oh, that was Georgia, yeah.
And he, like, hits a horrible-sounding crow call. Man.
There's, you know, calling, in my opinion, and, you know, how much I'm involved in the competition calling and competitive mm-hmm. calling and stuff, but I'm a turkey hunter at heart, and that's all I care to be known as is a turkey hunter. Mm-hmm. And I still say calling is, you know, 10% or less than the whole turkey hunting game. Mm-hmm. But saying that, people like that guy, they still need to practice calling.
I need to show it to you, Jay.
I was going to say, now, what's your main locator call that you like to use, especially in, like, the southeast, but also maybe if you travel out west?
I'll hoot a little bit, you know, in the mornings, but typically after that, I've got a turkey call. I'm striking them with a turkey call. Out west, I'm using a lot of coyote howls, you mm-hmm. know, anything loud, you know. They'll gobble at it, you know, and you can move in on them. So, yeah, as far as locator calls, I don't have anything in concrete. But if I'm walking for turkeys, it's usually calling. Okay. You know, I'm calling. So,
what was that guy doing? Was he
he's just a numbskull.
That turkey.
Yeah, see, we
up.
Were in trouble from the get-go. We got out of the truck mm-hmm. and was going to a spot. It was about a 20-25 minute walk, and this turkey gobbles 15 or 20 minutes before he was supposed to gobble, and he was literally right on the road. And I was like, I know we're asking for heartbreak here, setting up this close to the road, but it was a little less used road. And he was gobbling, so just
yeah,
gobbling in the dark. And I'm like, man, I can get close to him. So that's what we did. We just got super aggressive.
Yeah.
How close did you get?
70 yards.
Oh, maybe. Yeah.
I mean, I crawled in close, and it got broke daylight, and you could see him up there, silhouette on the pine limb, just walking back and forth, just gobbling and gobbling.
God, that's awesome.
And, about flight, I think I'd clucked at that turkey one time.
Mm-hmm.
I was so close, and I just needed to turn him on that limb. So I just, one time, and he'd thrown that head up, and I knew he heard me.
Mm-hmm.
I thought, I've influenced you. That's all you need to hear, you know. And about here it comes. I hear that gravel popping. I'm like, oh, man, shoot me now, you know. I knew what was fixing to happen. Then he drove past us. I thought, okay, by the time I heard his truck cut off. And then that turkey, it was early season. You could see him.
Mm-hmm.
And he could see a long ways through the woods. And that turkey saw that guy walk up, like no doubt about it. Dude walked down a white rock road, and there's no doubt about that turkey. You see his head come up, and his color changed in his head.
Oh, yeah.
It went that dull red color.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew that that turkey had seen that guy. So I just went quiet. He went quiet. And, you know, then the guy did his little rendition of whatever, you know, what not to do. And then he got back in his truck, drove back past the turkey. And 20 minutes later, the turkey was ready to fly down. And he did exactly what he was going to do like 2 hours before.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it just put everything on pause when that guy come by. And, but yeah, it was just, we had the luxury of being able to sit there and watch the turkey. So we were confident that, you know, he hadn't gone anywhere, you know. Mm-hmm.
And it was cool seeing that footage because you could really read that turkey's body language.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Dude, I got to watch that because I'm so, like, hungry. I was, like, so eager to learn and get so much information about that, like, especially body language of birds. Mm-hmm. That's the biggest thing for me because, like, deer, I got that.
Yeah.
Turkeys, I need to look at that.
Well, I mean, we talk about head color,
you know.
Yeah.
He was just brilliant. Red, white, and blue. He was strutting. I mean, everything was just
– He was ready to rock.
He was ready to rock, and then suddenly that happened, and that color just faded, and it just turned to a dull red. Mm-hmm. He folded those wings, and he had that long neck up, and he does that where he backs his head up, you know, mm-hmm. looking back. You knew he'd – and I knew exactly what he'd saw.
Yeah.
You know, obviously I couldn't move. I was pinned. But yeah, it's just that you could tell that he'd got nervous. But I knew we were in a good spot. Like, he was eventually going to have to come out of that tree. I thought our crutch was going to be because the guy approached from behind us, so he was going to push the turkey the other way. But luckily, he got comfortable enough after he left that he mm-hmm. flew down where he – what I think was going to fly down initially before that whole rigmarole happened. So.
Yeah, and he was on the ground a total of, what, 3 seconds?
At the most.
Before he shot him.
How close did he get when he flew down?
25 yards, maybe.
Dude.
Yeah.
Oh, God, I'm so jacked up for this season, man.
Yeah, I'm excited. That's like when you talk about calling to him on the limb like mm-hmm. that, the last one I shot last year, I had heard him gobble on the roost like way up this valley. I was on a different turkey, but I heard him gobble, and I kind of kept it in the back of my head. Mm-hmm. And I went in there like maybe a week later, and I got right to where about where I thought he was, and I sat there and like it started getting to be daylight, and I took out my pot call and I like clucked and purred or something, or I clucked twice. I just went burp, burp, and he like hammered it like 50 yards away, and I was like, put that down.
Yep, that's all that'll be. That'll be needed. Yeah.
20 minutes later, it came.
It's always that's an experience thing. You'll learn through experience on what you need to say. A lot of people are like, don't call the turkeys on the tree limb. I like calling turkeys when they're still in the limb. Mm-hmm. I feel like I've got the ability to influence which way they're going, but mm-hmm. you've got to read that. Yeah. If you're not in the perfect spot, you don't need to call to him on the limb.
Yeah.
Like if you don't have that perfect setup, you don't need to call to him on the limb because you don't want him coming to you and handcuffing you.
Yeah.
You know, there's been situations where I've had to let him fly down because I had to use a terrain feature. Once he was on the ground, them jokers can see a long way when they're 30 foot 60 foot up in a pine tree, whatever they are. Yeah. You know, so when you let them get on the ground, can use that roll in the terrain to get that perfect setup and then call to him. Mm-hmm. You know, that can be deadly, you know.
Yeah.
but everybody's got this set in their head that they've got to get to that turkey and call to him when he's on the limb.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he's no less a turkey, and he's not going to die any less if you wait till he's on the ground and you can get into that perfect spot. Because here again, it's all about location. It's all mm-hmm. about getting the right spot before you engage him, really.
Yeah. That turkey, he gobbled, and I put the call down, and like 10 minutes later he gobbled again by himself. I was like, yeah, you're going to get it. And and then I heard him pitch down, and we sat there, and I mean, it felt like an hour before he got in, but it's probably like 10 minutes or something, and he came in strutting and I killed him. One thing that I noticed about your videos that I found interesting, which mainly I've watched a lot of the Florida ones and Alabama and Georgia,
yeah.
I'm like working my way through it, and I was surprised at how much you call in certain situations.
Yep. Certain
like you call a lot in certain situations. I'm like, dang,
really? We do a lot. We do whatever it takes, really, whatever we feel is necessary. And a lot of that early season stuff, you'll see a lot of calling because we're competing with hens.
Mm-hmm.
You're trying to, you know, you almost can forget there's a gobbler there. I mean, you've got to provoke that hen. You've got to trip her trigger. You know, you're climbing on top of everything she says. You're trying to, like, you know, throw hot water, you know, or gas on the fire, I guess is the best way of putting it. Because a lot of times they're pretty docile early season. They're roosted right with each other and don't have any reason to get fired up. But if you get in there and you're an intruder and you approach their little circle there, you hear us talk a lot about calling almost as a reflex. Like when you hear them cut and you cut right back at them, like you're almost talking over the top of them.
Yeah.
And that can, you know, if you can get that hen to come in, that boss hen, the whole flock's coming and then he's with them. So mm-hmm. We're doing a lot of that. And when you're doing that, you're like what happened on one of those Alabama hunts is you get that satellite gobbler that's been pushed away from the flock for whatever reason. You know, he decides to pay you a visit because you're a flock that he don't have to fight for, you know.
Yeah.
So you get the advantage of that. But, yeah, we do a lot of calling in those type of situations. But in others, like you said, I think I clucked to that turkey a total of 3 times and killed him. So,
yeah.
It's all an experience thing. It's all reading what you need to do. There's no book to tell you what to do. You're not going to find a podcast that tells you mm-hmm. when to do which one.
Mm-hmm.
It's all an experience thing. And the only way that you're going to learn it is to get out there and get your feet wet.
Get out there and screw it up hundreds of times.
Yep.
Yeah. I was going to say, I've got my concluder, but I'm going to save it. Let's touch on NWTF and then we'll wrap it up with concluders.
Okay. Yeah, I think I've hit everything.
So we got you're calling this weekend.
Yep.
So this is recorded on Friday. What was the date?
15th.
15th. So before the Grand Nationals and everything else going on, kind of break this down. You know, last year you won it, which was freaking fantastic. Yep. That was the coolest thing to actually see it. Again, I didn't know you previously until that. But to kind of see someone win that and kind of the whole process of how it works and going to the competition and listening, closing your eyes and listening to the callers and being blown away by just the sounds that you guys produce. I mean, I told you that earlier that it was really inspiring to myself. I'm like, now I know I'm horrible at calling. Like, I mean, I knew I was bad. I knew I was really bad before. Now I'm like, dude, just garbage, like just trash. But it's just fantastic to kind of see guys like yourself be able to do that and try to take it to the next level.
Yeah.
You know, with calling. Because there's guys that they just want to call, you know, they're like, well, you know, I kill my judge, you know, talking about the turkeys, which is cool. That's cool. But to see someone take it to the next level and try to get into competition is crazy, man. And, dude, I hope the best for you tomorrow.
Oh, yeah.
We'll be there rooting for you.
We'll have our fingers crossed, but all we can do is what we can do. Yeah, for sure. Mm-hmm. But yeah, we'll be in there giving it our best shot. You know, hopefully we get a good clean run. That's all you can ask for.
Yep.
But yeah, I'm one of those guys that I turkey call because gives me something to do before turkey season, and it makes me practice. I'm not very disciplined at the whole practicing thing and running calls as much as I should. So this does at least get me to put those calls in my mouth before season gets here. And yeah, man, it was a fun experience for sure. Yeah, mm-hmm. it was something. Something I'll remember for sure because it's a big deal. I mean, it's a really big deal.
Huge.
I mean, these guys, there's a lot of these guys like that's all they want to do. Like that is the pinnacle. That's what they want to do.
Yep.
And it was fun. It really, really was to be etched in forever with some of the names that are up there. I mean, mm-hmm. Some of the the biggest names in turkey calling and turkey hunting probably even. Yeah, it's pretty humbling to know that your name's etched into that forever column with those guys. So
awesome!
Yeah, man, I'm excited. I can't wait to be sitting there watching y'all up there.
Yeah,
dude, it's gonna be awesome. I'm jacked up for it. Other than that, we can wrap it up because I have one concluding thought. Which my concluding thought is pressured public land birds,
mm-hmm.
especially you're getting 2 weeks into the season.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got a lot of hunters competition.
They've been hammered.
What is your go-to? Like, what are some ways you can get a bird to react to you and be able to bring a bird in that's been called to by who knows how many guys that's had a lot of things thrown at him mm-hmm. that first 2 weeks of season?
Pressured bird, well, you first off, the biggest thing is try to hunt them when nobody else is.
Mm-hmm.
Hunt them during the week. Hunt them when it's raining. Mm-hmm. Hunt them when it's cold. Hunt them when the conditions aren't there. Turkeys are turkeys, whether it's on private land or public land. They're still going to be turkeys. They're going to react the same. They're going to, they call it the same. They're there for the same reason. They need the same things. Pressure turkeys, the biggest thing is killing them before somebody else messes you up. So the biggest thing is, like I said, hunt them when nobody else is hunting them. Approach them from ways that other people aren't. Don't use those roadways that everybody – it makes easy walking. Don't mm-hmm. use – look for the corners of small pieces of public that may be overlooked by somebody, mm-hmm. or most people. Like I said, approach them from a creek bottom rather than the road that's on the ridge next to them. You know, approach them from a little bit differently. Read the sign, get in their hip pocket before they ever knew that you're there. I mean, learn them. Know that they're here because they're eating a certain, the pin oaks are heavy right here. That's why they're here.
Mm-hmm.
So beat them there. You can do all of that that puts, more of those, chips in your pile so that you can cash in, that other public hunters may not. They just may be going in there like everybody else, dragging their feet down the road, hollering with crow calls, hitting box calls, doing that same – present yourself differently.
Yeah.
I do think that being an advanced caller can put more realism into that approach that other people can't. There's been just a handful in the whole amount of time I've been doing this that I feel like calling was really a determining factor, but it was usually on that super public, a super pressured public land.
Yeah.
Because I did something that they weren't used to hearing, and I approached them in a different way. But yeah, I guess that's my stab at that question.
I appreciate it. 'Cause again, that's kind of the one thing that's kind of to me, other than just overall lack of experience and then calling skills, but like hunting pressure birds, like early season, we can get on birds. And if I could just like maybe stop moving and shoot straight, could kill some birds.
Yeah.
Like early in the season. But it's like later on in the season, you get so many guys that's been out there, they've been hunting.
A lot of those dumb ones are dead.
Most of the dumb ones. And that's why on some of these tracks, which we can talk about afterwards, I think they have a very well. I'm going to call it age class of turkeys. And there's probably a lot of old birds on this one track that we hunt. And it's like, they know. I mean, they know 2-3 weeks in, dude, like, slips
they
up.
Conditioned. What they do, they get conditioned.
Yeah.
They get conditioned to that, like, if something happened one time,
mm-hmm.
they would never act the same. But when something happens repetitively
mm-hmm.
in the same, and it's danger, you know, they equate that owl hooter or whatever to danger. Like, if they have repeated bad experiences with that, either a sound or a call or whatever,
mm-hmm.
that's what they condition themselves to, and it's just a survival. If you walked through a door and you got slapped in the back of the head every time, it wouldn't take you but two or three times, and you're going to be ducking when you go through the door.
Yeah.
Same way with them. They just condition themselves. That's what, you know, I was saying, like, if you present yourself differently,
yeah,
something they haven't been conditioned to, that's what you can find success.
That's one thing I'm going to try to do this year a little bit more is come in with creative access to
creative
spots.
Creative access, absolutely.
Once you find out where they're at, stop coming off those roads, because mm-hmm. we notice guys walking down these gravel roads and they're popping gravel while they're walking, because, mm-hmm. I mean, you cannot walk on a gravel road quiet. You just can't.
Nope.
And those dirt, I mean, we've hunted 1 year, or you had a situation, didn't you?
Yeah, there was a turkey on top of this ridge and these planted pines that was, like, I mean, burning it up, like, once, twice a minute gobbling, standing up there. And I couldn't get close to him because he's, like, 150 yards, like, wide open pine. Mm-hmm. So I was like, I'm just going to wait till he shuts up and try and figure him out later.
Yeah.
But he's up there just burning it up, and this guy comes crunching down the road walking. And he gets with an earshot, and the turkey just shuts up immediately. And you hear him crunch, 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 off into the distance. And he gets out of earshot, and the turkey starts right back up.
Yep.
Like
he's
happened.
Conditioned himself to that noise as being danger. Like he's had repeated bad experiences with that noise.
Mm-hmm.
He just knows every time he hears that noise, somebody come bumps him off the top of that ridge or shoots at him or something, you know.
Yeah.
Something happens bad.
Jacob shoots at him. That's the same ridge where he missed one. I called three longbeards
pouring
in for
salt
him,
in the wound,
and he peppered one of them in the butt.
Yeah,
I'm going to use this story. So they were like 10 degrees off from where he had his gun up, and I saw him go, and I was like, oh god,
he's going to shoot at a bobbin head. Yeah. Those pine trees.
So
they got a way of staying behind those pine trees.
Yeah, that was a bad morning. I try to forget that morning. Had one freaking ugliest turkey I've ever seen come up the hill towards. We're in these wide open pines, but it gets real thick down the bottoms, and they're on the other side of this bowl. One of these birds comes up, and I see it, and it's like 30 yards. I mean, it's like safety off shoot.
Yeah.
Instead of taking the safety off shoot, Andrew's like 5 yards to my left. I'm like, turkey. I didn't say it like that, but I was like, did this. And the bird looks at me, and it went back down the bottom. I was like, you son of a gun. And he's like, why'd you not shoot? I'm like,
this is like year one for Jeff.
Yeah, this is like year one.
New.
This is a couple years. Yeah.
He's green.
So I'm like, oh, whatever. So I'm sitting there. And we can see down these long pines. I mean, it's all select cut pines, planted pines, and you can see 80 yards down there. Also, I see three toms out there, and they're strutting. And I'm like, hey. And, like, I try looking. Andrew can't really see that well. And then finally they kind of start bobbing, weaving back towards us. And I thought they were with, you know, within range. I didn't have a rangefinder. So, like you said, had the gun, like, right here. I'm right-handed. They're on my right side. So, I had to, like, legit pivot all the way around and try to shoot. I did that, and one was like, what? And they, like, looked at me, and they dropped strut. Yep. And it started, like, bobbing like this. And
never.
I'm like, boom!
I know. I heard a putt, and I went, shoot!
Yep.
Yeah.
Game's over when that happened.
It was too far.
Over.
It was way too far.
Yeah, that's fun. Now, the last thing I wanted to ask about was how often, if ever, do you use, like, gobbler yelps or Jake yelps or gobbles?
Early season, it can be pretty effective because they're still flocked up, and those Jakes can – I think they provoke jealousy. I'm not real sure what it does. But you hear a lot of Jake yelps, and a lot of times what you don't realize is when that Jake yelp, he's yelping it at a gobbler strutting. If you get in close to him, you'll hear those gobblers like drum, and every time he drums, it provokes that Jake to gaw, gaw, gaw. And he's – so when you yelp to the Jakes – it provokes their interest, and the Jakes will come. Well, the gobblers are like, he's not making it to a hen without me being, you know, he's not beating me to that hen. So you kind of provoke them to all kind of, you know, join you. And I had a super awesome experience like that. We were down in this deep canyon in Arizona. Me and Squirrel, y'all saw him on the Pinhoti Project. He and I went down in this bottom, maneuvered our way into a whole flock of turkeys and started calling to them. They come up out of this little bottom, little swell, I guess it was. And gobbler came up, lone gobbler. I'm like, game on. You know, this is cashed in. About that time, he just stops. And we're like, man, what's going on? By the time the whole flock comes up, he was just leading the flock. And there was a big strutter in the back with a couple hens and a flipping gaggle of Jakes, like probably eight or so of them. And we sat there, and they just had hit their mark at about 70 yards or so. And they were out there just middling, doing their thing, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. And we couldn't get them to break. But those Jakes were, you know how Jakes will do. They'll chase each other around and whatever. But they were caulking. You know, caulk, caulk, caulk. At every time that gobbler would strut and drum, he'd caulk, caulk, caulk. So I let them do it one time. Then I responded to them with a Jake yelp. They caulked, and I'd caulk right back at them. Well, you saw them raise that head up. You know, they were like, hey, you know. Well, here they came. And there was an ant bed. Those turkeys out there eat a lot of fire ants. And there was a big ant bed right like 15 yards. And we had all eight of those jakes on that ant bed. They came running over and they started scratching at that ant bed. And we're laying down on the guns like this. And once the jakes broke and they came in there, the whole flock just slowly came in there. And we were able to kill the gobblers out of that flock. So it was one of those situations to where being able to read those turkeys and like, obviously the jake's the youngest turkeys of the bunch. Mm-hmm. So they're the easiest to influence. So like you use that chink in that gobbler's armor to where let's provoke that flock by causing them to break by using the dumbest birds, you know.
That's smart because so many guys talk about like trying to get that hen to come in. Mm-hmm. And sometimes maybe it's easier to just go after the jakes.
Yeah.
And just have everyone
the curiosity.
Follow.
And the gobbler also, you know, the gobblers and hens aren't always going to follow the jakes. Mm-hmm. But in this situation, they were all just kind of moving as a unit. And when we caulked at those jakes, and I've done that a number of times, you know, and you can see that when you're calling to a gobbler, he'll gobble to a hen yelp and whatever, but you caulk at him and it's like, man, it sets him off, you know. Mm-hmm. And you hear us do that, you know, quite a bit in the early season. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times I'll do it in response to him gobbling. He'll gobble and I'll caulk, 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 caulk right after it. Like,
oh, that's slick.
It's just another realistic thing. Like, he thinks not only is there a hen over there now, mm-hmm. there's a jake that, hey, I don't like that, mm-hmm. you know? So,
yeah.
You know, it's just another little added realism there.
Yeah. Now, does a gobbler caulk like a jake does?
They don't caulk like that. They got a little bit more. I mean, they can do anything probably. Yeah. But usually if you hear gobbler yelps, it's a little bit more polished. From what in my experience, mm-hmm. you don't hear them doing that ragged sound like a jake does, that almost a reflex sound where they'll hear something and it's almost like it.
Yeah.
You know, you don't hear that as much. Gobbler yelps are almost like more planned to me if mm-hmm. I had to describe it, which I'm probably doing a terrible job of doing, but
it's hard to explain.
Yeah, it's more they're it's like more scheduled, like they're they have it planned. They know what they're saying before they mm-hmm. they say it.
Because when I mentioned that one with Shane, that opening day turkey last year, he was gobbling, and I started jake yelping at him, and he started yelping back at me.
Like, oh, really?
After a while, he gobbled five or six times when I was hen yelping to him, but he was just, you know, strutting back and forth. So I started doing that, and he starts coming closer, and he starts doing it back at me.
Oh,
I mean, and
cool.
I was, like, arguing with him like you would a hen. Just like, yow, 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 and he'd do it right back. And, he got to 60 yards, and then a hen came in and got him.
Mm.
But – yeah, well, Dave, we've taken a lot of your time, and I want to say thank you for coming with us.
Man, you got it. It was a pleasure.
Yeah. Where can people find your stuff?
Pinhoti Projects on YouTube. That's our mainstream there. We're fixing to get going on the Mossy Oak Go app, if I'm not mistaken. We've done all the, we're going to be on there as well, so you probably find us on there soon, as long as there's no hiccups in that process.
Nope.
I don't really know what's all required, but I've signed the papers. So, anyways, I think it's fixing to happen. But yeah, YouTube, and then of course I've got a website, and we're on Instagram and Facebook, as you know. So anybody can hop on there, and just the only caveat is it's fixing to be turkey season, and I'm a turkey hunter.
Mm-hmm.
So all of these messages that I've gotten or little requests or whatever, I've tried to accommodate because it's off season. But it's fixing to be turkey season. I'm fixing to be extremely busy. So if it takes me a while to get back to you, not because I don't love you, because I do. But it's just that I'm going to be really busy, and we're going to be pumping out a lot of content this year and big plans and hopefully a you know, thriving future with the Pinhoti Project. So
I hear that, man. Y'all got some sweet hats too, so everyone go buy a hat.
We got hats and shirts. Yep. Dad can find those on the website. So
yeah. Well, Dave, appreciate it, man. Good luck calling.
All right. Thanks, man.
All
All right, I'm going to tell y'all how I like to use one of my favorite tools out in the woods, and that is the tracker from Onyx Hunt. So here's how I've been using it lately. I got this new property I'm going to be hunting this year, and the very first thing I did on the property was I went out and I drove all of the roads that are drivable in my truck. And I had the tracker on as I was driving around. So after I got done driving around, I selected the track on my app and changed it to where it's just a solid black line. So now I've got a really nice, easy to see roadmap of everywhere that's drivable in a truck on the property. So here's what that does for me so far. Now I've got an easy to read map of everywhere that you can drive in a truck on the property. But also that roadmap is actually very useful because it makes it very easy for me to see what roads are drivable and what parts of the property are most accessible and what parts of the property are least accessible. Like I said, one of my favorite tools. If you're not using it already, you should be. And if you want to give Onyx a try, go get an Elite membership and use the promo code Southern at checkout. That's going to save you 20% and it's going to help the show out. Know where you stand with Onyx Hunt. If you hunt deer out of trees, you need to go check out latitudeoutdoors.com. They got a little something for everybody, whether you're a saddle guy or if you hunt out of a climber. Of course, Latitude makes some of our favorite saddles and climbing sticks, but they also make some great packs and backpack straps that you can attach to the bottom of a climbing tree stand to make it more comfortable to carry in the woods. Probably my favorite piece of gear I've gotten in the last several years is the Ranger 22 from Latitude. It's like a do-it-all backpack for me. It's compact, which I like, but it's adjustable enough that it gets me through the whole season. It's the only pack I use. I use it in early bow season when I'm not carrying much in the woods, all the way to late January rut hunts in the deep south when it's cold and I'm carrying all kinds of clothes and all kinds of stuff on my back. The Ranger 22 is adjustable enough that I can just use that one backpack all season. And hey, all you Mossy Oak Bottomland fans, they just released the Ranger 22 in Mossy Oak Bottomland. So like I said, no matter how you like to hunt, Latitude's got something for you. Go check them out at latitudeoutdoors.com.
Well, guys, meet your new favorite summer scouting optic. And no, it's never too early to start scouting for the fall. Introducing the Vortex Crossfire Spotting Scopes with three different models of how you glass. Me and Andrew have both used spotting scopes in the summer to go out and glass fresh, clear cuts that's got a little bit of growth on them to find bachelor groups actually feeding in the summer. It's a pretty fun time, and also it's a great opportunity to take your kids out, especially if you can sit in the truck while you're glassing. And it's always one of those pieces of optics like to keep in the truck at all times because you never know when you might need it. Be sure to stop by your local Vortex dealer to get out the all-new Crossfire Spotting Scopes or to get 10% off your favorite spotter, head over to eurooptic.com and enter code Southern10 at checkout to save 10% on your order.
You know, one reason that we named our company the Southern Outdoorsman is because we're not just Southern deer hunters or Southern turkey hunters. We kind of hunt everything: quail, doves, waterfowl, rabbits, squirrels, you name it. I know a lot of you guys are the same way, and our friends at Whitetail Hill are like that as well. Whether you've got a hunting club, a lease, or your own property, they've got a blend for pretty much every situation on a piece of ground. I mean, they've got a seed blend for everything. If you want warm season deer forage, check out Summer Bulk. If you need to screen off a plot or cover an access route, Hideaway grows up to 12 feet tall and is built for that exact purpose. You got a duck hole or a pond edge? Check out the waterfowl blend. You want to plant for doves or quail? Check out their dove and quail plot. If you need soil that needs a little bit of work before fall, check out Dirt Doctor. And of course, they got a full cool season lineup ready to go when fall planting time gets here. And if you're unsure about what to plant, go to whitetailhill.com. They've got a seed selection guide on there that'll help you pinpoint exactly what you need on your property. So y'all check them out today. That's Whitetail Hill. Go to whitetailhill.com.